It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Mine land reclamation here in Appalachia is an ongoing experiment. This morning we'll hear about how some volunteers are helping out.
This is important because it helps cover up all the mistakes people have done within the mining and taking the coal off from the top layers. It makes it then look more natural, have it better, and more habitat for the animals.
We'll have that coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. A handful of demonstrations were held late last week in West Virginia ahead of the U.S. government's advertised raids on immigrants officials say are in the country illegally. Emily Allen was at the Capitol in Charleston last week as protesters told their stories of family separation and what they feel are misconceptions about the U.S. immigration.
As Ryan Brown stood outside the West Virginia Capitol on a breezy Friday evening, her husband Ali was in the northwest African country of Guinea. It's next to Sierra Leone, where Ali's from. Ali was deported back to West Africa in 2017 after his last attempt to seek asylum was denied in 2011. Brown and Ali had been married for 7 years when he was sent out. While he was here, Brown said Ali complied with immigration officials and worked hard to make his community a better place.
Ali's one of the kindest and most hardworking people I've ever met in my life. He helped my parents and other neighbors take care of their property. He volunteered to help fix homes for low-income families through a nonprofit called Livingstone, Inc. He helped my father take care of a mentally disabled family by taking them to doctor's appointments and picking up their groceries.
Brown spoke at one of 5 planned candlelight vigils in West Virginia through the national group Lights for Liberty. The 4 other events slated for the state were in Morgantown, Huntington, Charlestown, and Beckley. There were at least 700 planned vigils across the globe Friday night, days before a large-scale operation to detain and deport thousands of immigrants was expected to begin on Sunday. Although many immigrant communities were reportedly on edge this weekend, NPR reports that few raids have been confirmed. Back in Charleston during Friday's vigil, attendees heard from Jackie Lozano, a West Virginia resident benefiting from Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This program lets kids who entered the country with their families at a young age apply for permits, allowing them to legally live and work in the United States.
We're kids, that were brought to the United States as young children, and we've been here our whole lives. We really don't know much about our own countries. And we established our lives here. We were raised here. We have the American heart, as you can say.
Now a mother herself, Lozano says she understands why her mother risked so much to bring her family to the United States. Lozano urged people to understand Friday night, this is the same case with others entering the U.S. today.
I would cross any border. I would cross any desert to make sure that my child can live.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Allen.
Across Appalachia, more than 1 million acres of formerly mined lands are stunted, where native trees can't grow. Now, as Andy Cubis reports for the Allegheny Front, conservationists are using a new strategy to bring back forests.
Deep in the Moshannon State Forest in Elk County, Pennsylvania, there's a sloped patch of land surrounded by an otherwise healthy forest. It looks as if a tornado has torn through here. The earth has been churned up with tangled roots and jumbled rocks. John Hecker is a forester for the state.
And as you can see, it's a very bare site presently. I mean, there's no trees here.
In the late 1800s, this area was deep mined. Later, it was strip mined. When the coal companies left in the mid-1990s, the land was abandoned. Then, about 12 years ago, the site was reclaimed. That's the term for the federal government's directive to coal companies to make mine land useful again. Often that's meant planting trees, but they didn't take in this area.
The technology back then was to just recontour the land, but the bulldozers, as they ran over it, they compacted the soil. Well, the trees don't do very well in compacted soil.
Hecker manages this tract of land. He says now this and hundreds of acres of formerly mined land in Pennsylvania are getting an ecological do-over, Reclamation 2.0, you could call it. That's why the ground is ripped apart. A jumbo-sized bulldozer with a 3-foot blade came through here earlier in the year and crisscrossed the ground with furrows.
It also loosens the soil where that furrow is, and it allows the tree roots to grow down into that loose soil where it's moist, and those trees will really grow well.
This aggressive form of bulldozing is a relatively new technique. It's only been used for the last 10 years or so. It's called the Forestry Reclamation Approach. Scott Eggerud is a forester and regulator with the Office of Surface Mine Reclamation Enforcement, part of the Interior Department.
This is not what they taught us in school. What they taught us in school is you pack it in, you put aggressive ground covers under to stabilize the site.
And that's exactly what happened here. The non-native grasses they planted took over. They did really well on that compacted soil. But the problem was that the grass got so thick that rainwater couldn't seep into the ground. It might as well have been concrete. This new plan will change that.
Instead of water washing off the sites, it now infiltrates and it's more natural, the way it was supposed to be, the way it was before mining.
A crew of professional tree planters was brought in earlier in the week to get the bulk of the lot planted. And now it's up to volunteers to do the rest.
Take a seedling out of there, put your hand around the roots, stick it way down in the bottom hole, and pull it up so the root collar, right where the root starts, just a little
About 20 volunteers with big orange buckets gather around Eggerud. He shows them how to put the tree in the hole.
When you empty that bucket, we have a prize for you. Guess what it is?
Another bucket!
Another bucket!
Yes. I love other buckets!
They're planting over 2,000 trees today. White pine, quaking aspen, red oaks, and black locusts. They're all native tree species. The Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources grew and donated them.
I think we'll plant another pine.
The volunteers fan out, navigating the jagged terrain while carrying buckets of tree saplings. 12-year-old Trey Slavonic is quiet because he's really focused on what he's doing. He's here with his dad and little brother.
This is important because it helps, cover up all the mistakes people have done within the mining and taking the coal off from the top layers. It makes it then look more natural, have it better, and more habitat for the animals.
About half of this 45-acre site will be left as grassland. The wild elk in the region will like that. Laura Bray is the program coordinator for the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. She's overseeing this reforestation effort across the state.
It's nice to have these edges where you have mature forest, and then you'll have some grassland, you'll have some wildlife shrubs. It's a good opportunity for us to make this site productive again.
It'll be about 50 years before there's mature forest here again. Scott Eggerud, the forester, says it's not just about growing trees.
The trees are an indicator of the quality of that site. If we're growing nice trees, that tells us that we have a very healthy ecosystem. You can't replace everything that was here. You replace the major components, and it just speeds up the healing process.
Now that the planting is done on this site, next up is the Gallitzin State Forest in Cambria County. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
Best-selling author Sheila Redling from Huntington has written 9 books. After losing her will to write, she's back on track and more books are on the way. Eric Douglas spoke with her about the importance of protecting your ability to write, and she has some advice for other writers.
You've written a couple different series or got introductions into a couple different series, the Danny Britton series, the non-series.
Right.
Are both of those continuing?
Yes, they are. I had taken a few years off of writing. I'd gotten really burned out. I had been writing while my mother was dying, and I wasn't taking care of my writing process, which I think is something I wish somebody had warned me about that earlier. I've always been able to write, so I thought I'll always be able to write, even when the world is literally on fire over me. And I didn't take care of it, and I kind of wrote myself into a hole and ran out of the energy and the love of writing. I start to hate writing. And not the way you hate writing when you're in the middle of a book, because you always hate a book at some point.
You always hate a book in the middle, right?
But this was like, I was actually hating the act of writing. I was hating the thought of turning a book in. I was hating the thought of pitching a book. I should have seen the signs earlier, but I didn't.
Tell me about writing for you. What does it mean to you?
It means something very different to me now than it did 5 years ago even.
And you're fairly new to writing, I mean, or at least writing books.
For publication.
Right.
Right. I got my agent in 2009. Flowertown came out in 2012. And then I just, knocked out a bunch of books. And I loved it. It just was something I took to like a duck to water. I love reading. I loved writing. I love just making stuff up. I was a world-class pantser. Just writing without a plan. I would just start a series and see what would happen. And then, of course, like I said, I didn't take care of myself. And so having to come back to writing after that time, it's like coming back to a friend that you've lost for a really long time. Like you're both a little bit different, But we trust each other, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of finding that place where we trust each other and the story's coming back, and I'm gaining my confidence again in my ability to stick with the story. It's lovely. I mean, that's the word I would use for it. It's just a lovely homecoming coming back to writing. It is still my favorite thing to do in the world.
Which is both an important lesson for you to learn for yourself, but also for other writers to learn is don't squander it, don't waste it.
Listen to the signs when you feel yourself grinding on it, when the hatred goes from, oh, I just hate the story, I can't write, to, I hate this so bad. I don't have any more energy. I'm just dragging this animal out of my brain to die on the sidewalk. It's a pretty image for you. yeah, listen to that because it can cost you something that you really, really love.
Right. Yeah, we've all heard the really crappy advice to writers. And it's always...
There's so much.
Pretty much all of it is crappy advice to writers. But put that in a nutshell. That sounds like your advice to a writer is to take care of it, to not squander what you've got.
Right, to be mindful that your ability to do this is, at the risk of sounding adorable, it is a gift. And it was given to you on the condition that you'll take care of it. So be mindful that you're not doing it for the money, you're not doing it for anybody else, because everybody has this dream that they want to be published, and you think it's just going to solve all of your problems. It just comes with a new set of problems.
A pet peeve for me is always the concept of somebody being an aspiring writer. Now, you can be an aspiring author.
Right. Aspire to be published.
Aspiring to be published. But you don't aspire to being a writer.
Right. You either write or you do not write. There is no try.
There is no try. If you want to be a writer, then you set your butt in a chair and you go write. Now, it may be crap.
It will be crap, and that's okay.
And that's okay.
You have to put an awful lot of crap out. You know, something I did that helped me a lot with that got me back onto writing, was I started doing art in other mediums. I took drawing, I took sculpture, multimedia, and you know, you make an awful lot of crap in art classes.
But you act too, right?
And I act. Well, let's put air quotes around it. I act. I work on murder and merriment improv, the interactive murder mysteries, which is my... Acting is a pretty broad term for that. I walk in and act obnoxious, and I'm usually known as the killer. But even with that, a lot of it is I'm doing something that I have no skin in the game. Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if I'm any good at acting. It doesn't matter if I can draw. So I go into those classes with that abandon and that freedom that you have when you're a kid, because I was just there to do it. I didn't have to be good. I just had to do it. And I really enjoyed it. And that's where I tapped back into that sense of what I missed from writing, mm-hmm. writing for myself.
What's your high point for writing?
Oh, gosh. What do you mean? What was the best moment for
yeah,
me?
Yeah, you know, the first time somebody asked you for an autograph.
No, you know what it was? When the first time somebody showed me my book in the library. Because you get that Library of Congress thing, and that's cool. And, of course, just getting the contract is super cool. But, you know, you were a kid growing up writing and reading, like the library is where the real books were. And my book was just in a public library. I didn't put it there. Anybody could come across it. You think how many writers you came across as a kid just because you were at the library and mm-hmm. you pulled it off the shelf. Somewhere, somebody, some kid might be like, oh, that looks good.
What haven't we talked about that's on your mind lately regarding writing, being an author?
I think it's important, if you have the platform, to do what you can to encourage writers and the writing community, which is more than just inviting people to your book signing. So you have to get out and encourage writers, like young writers. You have to talk to schools. You have to give platforms. You have to buy people's books.
That was best-selling author Sheila Redling talking with our in-house author Eric Douglas. This interview is part of a series of discussions with authors from the region. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.